I suppose, well, I'm an example of somebody forced into the voluntary labour market, I don't know if that's a way to put it, because there's 4% unemployment in this country, but visually impaired 80% unemployment. This is largely because people have not got access to digitised literature, especially in academia. Largely, now, the technology is there, but students and colleges have resorted to just scanning in individual books and pages to try to digitise information that is accessible by everybody else. The publishers are afraid that if they release the books on disk, that people will be able to learn for free. So imagine if everybody's doing an essay at the same time in the library, and there's 600 people in the class, and there's only 3 of them books there. So rather than give every one of them 600 the extract or a few chapters that they probably need, for generally one chapter for the essay, you know, the students are forced to go out and buy these books for €40, €50, and it's ridiculous, you know. So yeah, learn for free and let it all be available. And I devote my life to putting stuff up for free and taking stuff, altering it a little bit that should be, that we've already paid for, the Irish taxpayer. Whether it's a Gaelic language dictionary, whether it's RTE stuff that they sell back to us. A Shannon singer gives freely of her own time. Somebody's paid to record her. 20 years later, it's remastered and sold back to us and copyrighted.
Yeah, can I add something to that? It's an interesting point. I opened up with that law, the American law, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And that made it illegal to get around a barrier, a copy-protected barrier. And unfortunately, what that meant, what that has meant, and fortunately that it changed in 2005, last year, but it prevented individual software companies from feeling free enough, from not being afraid enough, to develop software that can that can basically allow a computer to speak a text, because it's a far too long and technical story to like fully explain, and it's completely illogical, or you may, hopefully many people think it's completely illogical. But if you take an electronic book that has this copy protection, a software company that creates a program that allows it to be read aloud would be violating this law. And actually, there is a software programmer who was arrested in the United States in 2003 at a trade fair for software, because he had created, or his company, he was just, the poor guy was representing his company, he was a Russian software programmer. And that did just this. That circumvented the copy protection. So, unfortunately, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, for 7 years, had never been amended to allow for creating software programs that would allow software developers to have programs that could be read specifically for the blind. It didn't even allow for that.
Can I just augment that slightly? That the voice of voice synthesizer programs on computer like JAWS, the voice quality has not changed in 11 years. That's not because the technology is not out there, I'm sure of that. I know at least that Kurzweil was working on a program to replicate your own voice in reading back material to you in 1997.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, on this note, the other scary thing about these new copyright laws, like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, is that it allows for companies to take things that were in the public domain, specifically like the book Alice in Wonderland, and I'm saying specifically because there's a really sadly funny license agreement that states, you know, this electronic book cannot be given to a friend, this electronic book, and it has all these lists. And then the last statement is, this book cannot be read aloud.
Right.
Other questions? Thanks for bringing that up. It's yet another thing that I didn't have time to talk about.
Like in the United States, when they're enforcing the laws, and what sort of business sentences and fines are quite large?
Sentences and fines. Yeah, unfortunately, the United States copyright law has one of the, I think not one of, I think it has the highest fine structure, such that I may be wrong about, it's either $150,000 per violation per times duplicated or $250,000. I think it's about $150,000, which again, even if within American copyright law, this kind of appropriation is what's called a fair use, and in Canada, it's called fair dealing. So on one level, actually, America has a much more liberal law that allows for more kinds of quotations. But the flip side is that in order to actually get to the point where you're in court to defend yourself, defend your use as a fair use, you or your publisher is sweating the fact that you could, in the end, lose and be penalized $150,000. I'm pretty sure it is $150,000 per use per copy.
Could it not be a kind of a double-edged sword, getting onto a couple of different points in academia? First of all, I suppose there's pressure from the government on all academia that you have to be efficient, but you also have to produce graduates to fill the jobs that are available within the economy. So, say some things like Latin, Greek, etc., will fall by the wayside, so you've developed more engineers, etc. Now, it's hard to justify producing graduates in Latin and Greek when you need engineers. So how do you develop some kind of process where you encourage people to do these things but not to be a drain on the economy? Because it's not just the government, it would be the public who would be insisting on this. Also as well, in regards to, I'm not really sure about the WTO, but in my view, the what they try to do is they're trying to get, they say, the third world to accept intellectual rights and then swap it for, let's say, farm subsidies, get rid of it in America, Europe, etc. Now, can that not be used and abused and say, some kind of universities connect into universities in the third world and say, right, we'll abuse the intellectual rights here and we'll churn it out here. Not sure how it can be done, but in the kind of a Foucault situation where the more surveillance you have, the more ways and means you can undermine it.
Yes, that's a very complicated issue. But can I just get you to, like, just because it's so broad, I don't know what to answer. I mean, is there, like, particular... the thing is, I can talk about anything that you just spoke about because it's,
I work for the Department of Education, so I see the kind of pressures every day that just say you want to run a course. You have to apply to the department for permission to run the course. The department looks at, is there a need for this kind of graduate? If there's no need or there's no pressure built up from the public to do this course, or even from the, let's say, the stakeholders, let's say the regional bodies, etc., to do that, they will not go that route. But if there's enough political pressure there that's built up, they will consider it, especially if there's no resources needed. But if there's resources needed, they think 10 times about it and are extremely slow to move in something like that.
Yeah. I mean, the another thing that makes me think about is, something that you had mentioned in the first question, which is, what we're seeing and what we're going to increasingly see is, because of this pressure you're speaking about, they're looking for new sources of revenue. So cultural texts and other forms of information that had, up to, 10 years ago have been free can, because of these laws such as the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, can be recaptured from the public domain and then and sold. And universities especially, I see it at my own university, the pressures to, when we develop courses that can be then translated to distance learning or online venues, to propertize that and to find ways of generating new revenue because of this very pressure. So that, you know, it's yet another example of the ways in which information flows that had been more free. And I don't want to sound like I'm romanticizing this better time, like 20 years ago was all that great, but it certainly, you know, empirically you can show that there are certainly pressures on free flows of information, and you can certainly point to many, many instances where those flows have been shut down because of the various sorts of pressures you're talking about.
What are the solutions that you see?
Yes, that's a great question, because, you know, and it's one of the reasons why I wove in to my discussion this concept of open source software, the Creative Commons, this effort to try and find a middle ground between an all rights reserved system and a no rights reserved system. There has to be some kind of middle ground. And so, yes, I do see in the case of just sticking with software, I mean, one of the solutions is to quite simply create more freedom, because the more freedom, the more flows of information that open up. If you're speaking to, you know, even the biggest proponents of the neoliberalist agenda, as some of the biggest proponents of what we in the U.S. refer to as the libertarian movement, which wants to see fewer and fewer government, well, it wants to see deregulation of state policies. They actually do see the potential for profits, and actually the end results, like there have been profits from, for instance, the open source movements, because for instance, in the case of software, the money isn't really in the development of the software and the selling the individual software packages. It's in customer service and care when you call up Microsoft, when you call up whomever, and you have a problem. And so, for instance, the company Red Hat packages Linux, and there are tons of other companies that package Linux. And they're not claiming a copyright over Linux. They're just simply scooping it up, putting it in a package, creating an instruction book, giving it a customer service number, selling it to people. And so, like, all the different services surrounding software is where the money is. And so you have this instance where freedom, free flow of information, actually does create, in private sector, business growth. And you know, the same is true in other areas of culture, but I don't, the same is true, for instance, I just take like one small example, the American band Wilco put out an album or recorded an album that was seen as very commercial, which actually it wasn't that unbearable to listen to by any mainstream ears. But the record company thought it was unlistenable, dropped the band. The band just decided to, while it was looking for a new record contract, to put up its files for the album, the songs, on the web. And this was also partially in response to the fact that it was already going up on file sharing networks. Well, this uncommercial album, once it was finally released, once it found a new home, resulted in double sales that any of their previous albums had. Now, the counter-argument that the music industry uses is that this probably hurts larger acts like Madonna and U2 more. It may like cut into a certain number of millions of sales that they get. But many studies, and there's just no way to like empirically prove any argument, but there are many studies that have suggested that, you know, a certain amount of freedom, a certain amount of free circulation of the music provides publicity, like with of Wilco, attracts listeners who will then go out and buy the music. So my answer, to just sum it up, is kind of economic progress and freedom in the kind of free speech, not free beer sense of the term. Economic progress and freedom aren't mutually exclusive, that they can work in tandem. And in some cases, especially in the realm of genetic research, there are cases upon cases of examples where drugs can't be developed because increasingly drugs are relying on genetic research and the use of information found in particular genes. And you have a situation where in order to develop a drug, you have 9 different genes you have to license that are owned by 9 different companies that you have to go through and negotiate. And speaking to, when I interviewed a bunch of different people about this, and one person whose job it is to, it's her job to basically negotiate the license agreements. She refers to it as a stacking of licenses. And she says, sometimes it's just the case where it's going to be too expensive to put out the drug because you're going to be paying out more to all these different gene owners, which, you know, I still retain the common sense notion that genes should not be privatized. That, and so that's an instance where the privatization of information can actually inhibit, you know, economic growth, and more importantly, the health of, you know, the citizenry.
I was very interested in all your talk, but I was particularly interested in what you said about academic publishing, particularly about journalism. And I was thinking to myself really that a lot of the problems that arise here are really due to academic ignorance about the possibilities that are out there. I know I belong to a European society which publishes a very prestigious top citation journal which was bought recently
by Black Belt.
And we spent a lot of time in the specific committee sort of deciding how that should be negotiated and what rights our members and so on will continue to have. And I don't think it's fair to any single one of us to raise the issue of what would happen with copyrights in that context. So, but it seems to me that there's a certain amount, there's a greater degree of flexibility when you publish papers as part of a book collection than in a journal. And I'm just wondering how far does this go in your estimation? I know a couple of years ago a number of sociologists managed to get books published in Ireland where the authors retained individual copyright claims instead of the publisher or the editors getting the entire copyright. To what extent is it possible to get books published by established and powerful publishing houses and to use something like a copyleft type of agreement instead of copyright? And if that isn't possible, do we end up really with the development of two parallel worlds of information in a sense, one of which is completely controlled by copyright and the other of which has to circulate in some rather devious and low prestige ways and for the love of freedom of information and no other reason really.
What I'm hoping will happen and what is just beginning to bubble under in the US at least, and I just hope that it continues to spread, and it's my own ignorance of this movement outside of the US. Similar to the open source movement, librarians are pushing for what's called an open access journal movement, where basically humanities societies, engineering societies, you know, all the different academic groups will, you know, collectively run journals, especially now that most people do not access and read journals from a paper printed source, which greatly, greatly, greatly reduces the overhead, which isn't to say that there's no overhead because then there's still copy editing costs, there's all sorts of costs, but it still lowers the costs. And what librarians in the US are pushing, and they've slowly been succeeding, especially amongst tenured faculty, which I hope to include myself in the next year, and is to contribute to open access journals, because what is driving librarians crazy is that at universities such as the University of Iowa and all other public universities, you have public funding paying my salary at a Research One university, at a research university, public funding paid my salary to produce knowledge, to produce scholarship and words, that then gets handed over to, let's say, Taylor and Francis or Blackwell. So the libraries find themselves having to pay twice, or the state, that is paying twice to allow us, other scholars, to have access to our own ideas. They're paying us, you know, supporting our salary so that we'll produce it, and then the libraries have to, you know, buy back that access. It's not true with open access journals, and there's no reason why that can't take off, because, you know, these societies, like the National Communication Association or the International Communication Association, still have, you know, home offices that, well, at one point they house the editorial journal offices, and that's what the membership dues paid for, to support also the journal. And so that if you can turn this journal, and you can turn this journal that's disseminated largely electronically, the dissemination costs are free. You still go through the peer review process so that it has the same prestige, especially if you have a good editorial board, and that, again, is what librarians are pushing in the U.S. for us to do. And I think it's something that we should do, because this system, the system that we live in, creates also like a two-tiered system, a system that if you have access to a library, if you have a library card or some sort of university access, you can access this journal information, information in journals. But then there are all the other citizens who, for instance, pay taxes for us to produce the information, who don't have access to it. But the open access movement solves both issues to a certain extent. Does that answer your question?
Do I have much time?
I think it's about 20 past.
Yeah.
We have one or two questions. I'll ask the first one. As far as maybe comparing academics to pop stars, when you look at people like Christina Aguilera, and when she goes to record a song, a lot of times she'll have to pay something like $50,000 for the drum sample or something crazy or exorbitant like that. So then the common sense, I guess, the marketing she has to do for the album is to make sure that that album can't get too political either one way or another, either to the right or to the left, because she needs to keep the market very big so she can make back the money for all the samples that she bought. Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that's the way that academics will have to go? I guess it's kind of connected to Hillary's question. Well, just that if... Say if you're Anthony Giddens and not Christina Aguilera, and so will it produce more, say, a restriction of different voices? Like today in the pop music world, a lot of the voices, there might be different people, but it's the same type of voice. Is that where you see it would go in academics?
Yeah, I think I understand your question. Let me just restate it for especially those who might not know what a sample is, like digitally sampling or digitally quoting a drum beat or a melody from another song, putting it in your song, Christina Aguilera's song. And the analog to that in academic publishing would be quoting, for instance, James Joyce. And there was a book that came out in 2003 that the Joyce Estate, speaking of like politically unsettling issues or just any kind of troubling issue. I mean, I think there's a more low-level impacts that copyright laws, copyright restrictions can create, even if you're not an Anthony Giddens, even if you're just me.